Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, the head of the US Central Bank says the time has come for interest rate cuts. We'll look at what a pivot back to strengthening the job market could mean for Americans and ask if inflation is really beaten. Plus, open source are the behemoths of the new tech economy about to open up their operating codes to developers. And as Saudi Arabia hosts the eSports World Cup, some gamers are accusing the organisers of sports washing. But first, let's go to the US, where at Jackson Hole, if Thursday's focus was on the speech from the woman in Chicago who wanted to be in charge of the United States next year, Friday saw an address by the man who will set the economic weather for the election campaign. Jerome Powell chairs the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and he struck some surprising notes. He said the time had come for interest rate cuts.
Overall, the economy continues to grow at a solid pace, but the inflation and labor market data show an evolving situation. The upside risks to inflation have diminished, and the downside risks to employment have increased. As we highlighted in our last FOMC statement, we are attentive to the risks to both sides of our dual mandate. The time has come for policy to adjust. The direction of travel is clear, and the timing and pace of rate cuts will depend on incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks.
Mr. Powell also said the bank was increasingly focused now on the job market as it gains confidence that the U.S. was moving past the surging prices that had started during the pandemic.
The FOMC's primary focus has been on bringing down inflation, and appropriately so. Prior to this episode, most Americans alive today had not experienced the pain of high inflation for a sustained period. Inflation brought substantial hardship, especially for those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials, like food, housing, and transportation. High inflation triggered stress and a sense of unfairness that linger today. Our restrictive monetary policy helped restore balance between aggregate supply and demand, easing inflationary pressures, and ensuring that inflation expectations remained well anchored. Inflation is now much closer to our objective, with prices having risen 2.5% over the past 12 months. After a pause earlier this year, progress toward our 2% objective has resumed. My confidence has grown that inflation is on a sustainable path back to 2%.
Jerome Powell. On the other hand, the jobless rate in the U.S. has ticked up to 4.3%, reviving fears that the Fed's policies will knock the expansion off course and throw millions of people out of work. Jerome Powell was, of course, speaking about all this at Jackson Hole. Now, that's a resort in Wyoming and also the annual gathering place for central bankers from around the world. Well, Gina Smialek is a reporter covering the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy for the New York Times. She's there and she joins me now. Gianna, thanks for being with us. First of all, before we get into what's been said, tell us about Jackson Hole. I mean, what sort of a place is it?
It is in the middle of the Grand Teton Mountain Chain, so it's very beautiful. It is surrounded by big mountains and big, beautiful blue lakes. There's really good hiking, good fly fishing, very, very outdoorsy. And it is the conference itself is held at the Jackson Lake Lodge, which is a historical lodge built mostly by the Rockefeller family. That is in the middle of the Grand Teton Park. So very remote, very pretty, very scenic. Obviously a nice place to hold a conference.
Yeah, a good place to have if you want to talk, I suppose, and perhaps not be overheard if you're a central banker from, well, any part of the world, really, and you want to discuss things that aren't going to be leaked, perhaps. It has become a real tradition, hasn't it, this meeting where central bankers compare notes?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been going on since the early 80s sort of the current format. And ever since the late 80s, the Fed chair has made a habit of speaking at this event. And so it's a really, really big deal, both in central banking circles, but also in media circles and policy circles more broadly. And it's very exclusive. It's invite only. They keep the guest list very small. And so getting invited to speak at it is a huge honor. And I think sort of something that really makes economists' careers.
Okay, so that sort of sets the scene. But from what you've been reporting there, Jenna, I mean, do you get a sense that the central bankers gathered there, and we said they're from all over the world, are they all really on the same page as far as what they need to do and indeed what they are doing to try and keep their economies going, including, of course, tackling inflation?
Yeah, you know, I think we're seeing them be a lot more on the same page than they have been in some past years. It seems like everybody is simultaneously sort of getting ready to back away from the very high interest rate policies that they have been using to tackle inflation. We heard from Jay Powell earlier today. He was sort of the headliner, the Fed chair, and he very much signaled that the Fed is likely to cut rates in September. And then we heard from Andrew Bailey, who's head of the Bank of England. And you know, I think similarly, it seems clear that the Bank of England is also well on that path. And so, you know, we're at a situation where I think inflation is coming down around the world, and people are hoping that they can kind of keep their economy chugging along even as inflation falls.
Yeah, I mean, there are one or two outliers. I suppose the Bank of Japan, I mean, they're one of the few that's actually raised interest rates recently.
Yes, so the Bank of Japan is in a slightly different situation, and they are, for partially for currency reasons, they are raising interest rates. So they're a little bit of an outlier. But, you know, I think you look at the bulk of central banks, you look at the Bank of Canada, you look at the ECB, you look at the Fed, the Bank of England, all of the big ones, other than the Bank of Japan, it does seem to very much be sort of the story of inflation really starting to moderate and that making central bankers feel a lot more comfortable about where their policy is.
Yeah, because they haven't been a popular bunch in recent years. I think it's fair to say a lot of people deeply suspicious, perhaps even of the mechanisms that they have to hang, which really are interest rates, and that perhaps they use them too much, too often, too hard. Do they feel, do you think, from what you're hearing there, a bit beleaguered, a bit disliked, perhaps? Or do they now feel, well, you know, we've done our job and it's all coming right?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a little combination of the two of those things. So I do feel like there is a sense and a sort of almost a palpable feeling here that they have pulled it off. You know, they wanted to quash inflation and do it without tanking the economy in the process. And they've achieved that. And I don't think that was an easy task. So I think everyone is feeling a little bit triumphant. But they're also clearly very cognizant. This has been a painful period for a lot of people. It's been very difficult to get into the housing market. Housing affordability is bad because mortgages are so expensive. And it's also, you know, people really are still feeling the lingering effects of this inflationary period. And so I think we really saw Jay Powell in particular with his speech this morning try and be cognizant of that and try and sort of nod to the fact that this has been a very unpleasant period for a lot of consumers where they've really felt bad about inflation.
Certainly has. Gina, thank you so much for being with us. Gina Smialek there of the New York Times reporting for us live from that place where all the central bankers are gathering at Jackson Hole. But what about what now seems then to be the main focus of the Fed's concerns, at least, which is joblessness? The number of new unemployment benefit claims in the US increased slightly last week, indicating a gradual cooling of the labour market. Initial claims rose by 4,000 to 232,000. Despite this, layoffs remain historically low, with firms scaling back on hiring. Let's hear from someone at the sharp end of all this. Nasser Al-Samadisi lives in Dallas, Texas. He's got a background in IT and has been looking for work for quite some time. He actually joins us on the line now. Nasser, thank you so much for being with us here on World Business Report. Just give me a sense of how it feels for you. I mean, you're trying to find work. What's happening with you at the moment?
Thank you, Roger. Yeah, so at the moment, I've been basically a full-time job seeker for about 9 months. And it's really, really, really strange. At least in the tech market, it doesn't feel like unemployment is between 3 to 5%. And all the people that I've asked for help, half of them also got laid off, and it's difficult.
It sounds really strange, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you're in a world where I assume, you know, tech people want tech people to work for them. It's a growing sector. Why is it proving so difficult?
I think it's a combination of things. So during COVID, a lot of these companies overhired. They basically, all of their customers were home 24/7 on their computers or on TV, and money was just rolling in. And after COVID, some of the decisions that they made weren't sustainable, and layoffs followed. So many, many tech companies laid off a lot of people. And again, the job market, there are so many people in the tech industry. I'm a user experience designer. Looking for jobs, that every company can be as picky as they want and only hire a unicorn.
So, Nasser, have you had a lot of interviews?
Oh, good God, yes.
And what happens? Do they just kind of say, yeah, we found somebody? I mean, you know, how do they treat you?
Well, I've had the spectrum. At the very beginning, I had really amazing interviews, and I even had not just an email, but I had a video call come back explaining, hey, we love you, but this one reason, and we hope you find what you're looking for. Like, they were very responsive and actually explained why that decision was made. And on the other end of the spectrum, you get ghosted. You don't even get an email.
It sounds really harsh, and I mean, you know, I'm not going to spread your age around the internet, but you're in your late 40s. I guess, does that count as old in your sector?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
How do you fight that? How do you deal with that?
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm my actual age. I feel a whole lot younger. But again, I was just speaking to one of my friends yesterday. He's been out of a job for 14 months, a little over, like closer to a year and a half. And it you look at who's being hired and who's being laid off. And again, it's a pattern that I see over and over again.
Nasser, I do wish you the very best of luck, and thanks for being with us here on World Business Report. Good luck with that. Nasser Al-Samadisi there, live on the line from Dallas. So what will the Fed's new direction, which we heard today, of course, from Jay Powell, do for people like Nasser and for the U.S. economy more generally? Let's talk now to Anders Persson, who's Chief Investment Officer and Head of Global Fixed Income at the global investment manager Nuveen. Thanks for being with us here on World Business Report, Anders. Just we were talking there, obviously, to Nasser. I mean, is something like the easing up of interest rates going to allow companies to invest more and therefore perhaps, you know, just make sure that the job market doesn't go in the way that clearly Jay Powell doesn't want it to go?
Yeah, no, that is certainly the thinking here, that as we ease sort of the pressures here in the economy and rates start coming down, the hope is that we can balance sort of the slowdown in the job markets and get the economy going again so that, you know, not facing those kind of pressures from the job market's perspective. You know, obviously, Chair Powell is looking for that soft landing and avoiding the harder landing. And you know, right now, that's the step that he's starting towards and he was indicating in the meeting today.
Yeah. Were you surprised by what you heard from him?
No, not really. I would say he pretty much messaged what the market wanted to hear, that the time has come for rate policy to start adjusting. They're mindful of the slowdown in the job markets. He definitely stressed, in my mind, that they're more focused on the job markets now and less focused on inflation. So I think the market was hoping for that kind of type shift. He did stress, of course, that data dependency is going to continue. But all in all, I would say it was, you know, a bit dovish, so to say, but that's more or less what the market was hoping for. So no real fireworks, but also reassuring at the same time.
Well, I'm going to push you for a little bit of a prediction, Anders. I mean, people are talking about in September, the first cut, 50 points, do you think?
No, our expectation would be it's going to be 25 basis points as we're sitting here today. I mean, there will be another key data coming out in September on the non-farm payroll. So if that's surprisingly different, perhaps 50 basis points could be in the mix. But we think the bar is quite high at this point to go all the way to 50 basis points. And it might even send a little bit of the wrong signal to the markets that things are worse than expected. So my expectation as we're sitting here today is actually 25 basis points.
No, it's interesting you talk about the markets there. I mean, you're in fixed income, of course, and it was interesting what Treasuries did in response. I mean, clearly, you know, the yield dropping quite dramatically. Was that, again, what you expected in terms of a response?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I would say the market has been pricing in this shift towards a cutting cycle for some time, particularly after we got that weak job market number a couple of weeks ago. So I think, again, having just reassurance that Powell and the Fed overall is focused on this. They made a shift towards, you know, being more focused on jobs and less so inflation, I think was just reassuring. So no, I think the yield movement was sort of in line with my expectations and seems quite rational at this point.
Yeah, and so you basically think Jay Powell's got it right fundamentally, that he's called it at the right moment, because there's always this issue of, you know, you put your foot on the accelerator, you put your foot on the brake. As a central bank, it's a difficult call. Has he made the right decision?
Yeah, I would say so far he has balanced things reasonably well. I mean, I think we're seeing the economy holding up you know, better than expected. The soft landing is sort of the base case for the markets and our expectations at this point. And, you know, he's balancing the inflation and the job markets as well as one could expect. So, yeah, I mean, I think the one side effect is that he's been very clear he's going to be data dependent. And because of that, the markets is reacting to every data point that's coming out, and that's creating a lot of volatility in the treasury market in particular. But that, quite frankly, is a bit of a byproduct here that I think the market's just going to have to deal with. So all in all, so far, he seems to be handling this fairly well.
All right. Thumbs up from you, Anders. Anders Persson, thanks so much for being with us. Anders Persson there of Nuveen. Well, we talked about the markets there, market reaction. Let's check in with Philip Richter, founder and president, Hollowbrook Wealth Management, who joins us now. Philip, I mean, you heard there from Anders, I guess, a sense that things are looking up. I mean, certainly if you looked across the share markets in the aftermath of what Jay Powell had to say today, I mean, you would have to say it's been a big uptick, hasn't it?
Yeah, I would agree, Roger. I mean, obviously yields fell and markets rallied. And I think the news from Jackson Hole gave relief and clarity to market participants. It's been a little bit of a opaque, murky outlook on rates, and we've been talking about all these cuts. They didn't happen in the beginning of the year. So I think there's clarity now, at least in the short term, that the markets liked. But I do think it's not clear that inflation is beaten. But the data is emerging that employment is cooling. Europe is definitely slowing down. We obviously know that China is slowing down, which has a huge impact on the global economy. So, you know, the data is emerging and the Fed is reacting. And I do think that, you know, Powell does not want to be compared to Arthur Burns. If you have some older viewers here,
go on. Just quickly remind us, Philip, who that is.
Well, so Arthur Burns was chairman of the Fed during the 70s, and the Fed, you know, was vexed by the complexity of inflation, which they would cut rates and inflation would take off again, and then they would raise rates and cut rates. It was almost like a, you know, an airplane trying to find altitude. And finally, it took Volcker coming in, you know, to slam the door on it. And so I think that Powell's call back in 2021 on transitory inflation is in the back of his mind. And he's been criticized by people like Larry Summers and other luminaries for those moves during that period. So I think he's not going to do a 50 basis you know, point rate cut. I think he's right. He's going to probably do a 24 basis point, you know, 20 to 25 basis point and see where we are.
Well, that will be interesting to see. Philip, thank you so much for your insights on that. Philip Richter of Hollowbrook Wealth Management joining us there. And a reminder, you're listening to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, much of the digital world relies on something called open source software, computer programs whose underlying code is published to the internet, free for developers to tinker with. Mozilla's Firefox browser, of course, the publishing platform WordPress, they're just two examples. But there's a big debate within Silicon Valley over whether companies should make AI open source. While Google and OpenAI are keeping everything walled off, Meta has embraced the open source route, allowing pretty much anyone access to their powerful large language models. The stakes are high, not only for which companies will come to dominate AI, but for the safety of us humans. Matt Levin from Marketplace reports.
Nils Tracy admits his business probably wouldn't exist without Llama. That's the name of Meta's open source AI.
No, I don't think it could. The backing of Meta and the power Meta has to build that model enables us to do this.
Tracy is the founder and CEO of a North Carolina startup called Blinder. It's basically AI for law firms. It can do things like redact documents or automatically file for copyright protections. Tracy's company copied all of Llama's source code, made some tweaks, and then retrained the AI to write like a lawyer.
We have contracts from a law firm or other types of documents they might have that are written in their style. We will train it off of that, and we will get it to learn that style of writing.
Tracy could have tried to adapt large language models from OpenAI or Google or other AI companies, but without their underlying code, he'd have to trust they weren't misusing his data. Also, they're not free.
Are you paying Meta in any way?
No.
How happy are you about that?
I'm very happy about that.
that open source models is extremely valuable for anyone downstream who wants to use it to be able to develop a new product or a new application.
Elizabeth Seeger is director of digital policy at the think tank Demos. If you're wondering why Meta would spend tens of billions developing its own AI only to give it away for nothing, Seeger says there's an economic strategy behind that. It's called commoditizing the compliment.
Let's say you are a hot dog producer. So you make hot dog buns completely free. So everybody can get their hand on hot dog buns, but then they need to buy your hot dogs.
In this case, Meta's free hot dog buns would be its open source AI. In the future, hot dogs could be data sets Meta will sell you to train it, or Meta hardware the AI runs on. Traditionally, with open source software, there's another benefit too. If there's a security problem, the global developer community is there to spot it. Ali Farhadi is CEO of the nonprofit Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence.
Do I rather live in a world where there is actually a large number of practitioners who know how to fix AI models when an attack or misuse happens, or a world in which I'm at the mercy of a couple of institutes?
But not everyone agrees that open source sunshine is the cure for AI security. Programmers have already removed safety restrictions from some open source AI models to create deepfake pornography. Aviv Avadia at the AI and Democracy Foundation says he worries about future catastrophic outcomes, like bad actors figuring out how to use open source AI to build a biological weapon.
It's much easier to improve and learn about AI systems if they're open and available, but it's also much easier to weaponize them, and there's no undo once they're out in the world.
Avadia says thinking about AI as completely open source or completely black boxed is kind of a false binary. Different levels of openness can apply to different types of AI.
And that was Matt Levin of our US partner Marketplace reporting there. Now let's talk about esports. Sunday night we'll see the closing ceremony of what has been described by the host Saudi Arabia as the largest event in gaming and esports history, the Esports World Cup. Over the past 8 weeks, 1,500 elite computer gamers have been competing in 22 tournaments with a $60 million prize pool, a record for esports. The Saudi hosts claim the event has had record viewership and participation and solidifies its position as a global hub for the sector and a leading destination for major sporting competitions. It's the latest sports event, of course, to be held in Saudi after high-profile tournaments from tennis to boxing to golf. And it has inevitably faced accusations it's being used to sports wash the kingdom's controversial reputation on human rights. Let's talk now to Rod Breslau, known as Slasher, well-known figure in the gaming community, reports on the industry. Rod, thank you for being with us. First of all, I mean, how controversial is it in the gamer community that the Esports World Cup is in Saudi Arabia?
Thanks for having me. I would say, personally, I am not covering the event. I am not watching the event. Many of my colleagues refuse to work the event who are big-time hosts and big-time broadcasters. We are generally aligned that this is a sports-washing event. We do not want to support it. We do not want to help promote it. And I will say, they say it's the biggest event. They say it has record viewership. All of that is not true. It's doing okay, and they did throw more than $60 million in prize money at the event, but it is not the biggest in terms of prestige. It is not the biggest in terms of viewership. And it is not the biggest in terms of how many people, especially, are watching in attendance at the event. The Saudis are really trying to elevate their own event, you know, in the international world to make it seem more important than it is.
But that's kind of what sports people do, isn't it? I mean, if, you know, the French said, oh, you know, the Olympics is one of the best that they stage there is one of the best. It's just the way it works. I mean, that in itself is presumably less of a problem than what you call sports watching. So let's break that down. Why are you not watching, not taking part? What is fundamentally your problem with it?
I mean, the frustrating part of it, I mean, of course, I am big about Saudi human rights. I mean, there was a fitness activist only a month before EWC started that was jailed for 11 years. I was an avid reader of Jamal Khashoggi from The Washington Post, who was decapitated several years ago by the crown prince. I do not support, you know, any of these things, any of these efforts that they're doing there. The issue in this event in particular is it would be like if they bought the PGA Tour instead of just launching the LIV Tour in golf. It would be like if they had half of the Formula One races in F1 instead of just a couple. The amount of investment and the amount of money that they're putting into all of video games and esports trumps all the investment that they're putting into Formula One and wrestling and golf. It really has become a problem how influential that they've become.
But Rod, isn't that really the point? That by injecting this money into esports, then esports is the beneficiary, isn't it? Because it becomes bigger, it becomes more people will want to watch it. It's all gain in those terms, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't dispute that. I mean, esports has gone through some financial problems in the last couple years, and this money is a big injection to players and organizations and teams and the game developers who own the IPs who are working with the event. I do not dispute that. But just based on the human rights aspect of this, we are not huge fans of what they are doing.
And is that true throughout the gamer community? I mean, how many people are taking part in this then? Does everyone think the same way as you do?
I would say there's a good amount of support in terms of the boycott, in terms of not supporting and not watching. However, if I'm going to be completely honest, I don't think it really works so well. The viewership is still pretty good. There are still a lot of people tuning in. I don't really know how effective our boycott has been, but you know, I have to stick to my morals. Our colleagues do too. We have to at least try to do something.
Well, we'll see how it all works out. It's going to be very interesting. But thank you so much for being with us. It's Rod Slasher Breslau, well-known figure in the gaming community, airing some of the concerns that there are about the Esports World Cup currently taking place in Saudi Arabia. And that's pretty much it from World Business Report. For me and the rest of the team, thanks. Bye-bye.